WB paid big bucks to put that on there, and that's what's keeping their site running right now.
Yeah, and let me tell you how many people went and saw Fantastic Beasts just because of the IMDb landing page. Fuck you.
Well, I have a lot to choose for with my cold open. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From San Diego, California, you are friend of the show, Keith Foster.
You are Cassidy Robinson. You're from L.A. And Cassidy, quick question. Am I the Jabber or the Drone?
Now, when you say L.A., you have to be a little more specific because that could mean Los Angeles or Louisiana.
Oh, no, it couldn't. No one says that they're from the state initials. Yeah, I'm from CA. No, fuck anyone who says that.
I used to give Richard shit because he would say Portland, and then I would say Portland, Maine, or Portland, Oregon.
Ugh, you're the worst.
I am.
You make fun of me and the stupid Am I the Jabber or the Drone bit, and you do that? Fuck you.
Getting off to a great start here on this show. We just had our holiday, the American traditional holiday, Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Although I was listening to a podcast recently that where one of the podcasters is from Canada and from Toronto, and he was talking about Thanksgiving. I was like, wait, why would you guys do Thanksgiving? So I guess that's a continental holiday.
Interesting. You know what's weird? I don't really think of it as an American holiday. Isn't that strange?
But it's like, it's archetypically American, because the whole thing is about how pilgrims, like, got along with the Indians long enough for them to teach them how to, like, hunt and fish and grow crops.
Yeah, but we weren't really America then. We were the colonies, and some of those colonies were French colonies that became Canada. So, I mean, it makes sense that they might have a Thanksgiving, too.
Okay. What did you do for Thanksgiving?
My wife Ashley and I, we went to visit her aunt in Temecula, and it was good. You went with us last year, and I meant to invite you again this year. Sorry.
I had to work anyway, so otherwise I probably would have contacted you earlier on, because I figured that's what you'd be doing again if you weren't, for whatever reason, back in Idaho. I've been there. It's a nice house. Good digs.
Yeah. We had turkey, candied yams, green bean casserole. Not green bee. That'd be weird.
That would be weird. I worked. But fun. We had a short day, so we closed at 3 o'clock.
Well, that's nice, at least.
9 o'clock. But all of my friends are gone, so I had nowhere to go. So I went back home, but... So I decided my Thanksgiving meal would be KFC.
Ugh, that's so depressing. Don't you have a story like that once?
Yes, the most I maybe have told this story on the podcast before. I don't remember, but the most depressing Thanksgiving of my entire life, maybe the most depressing day of my life.
I'm pretty sure you have told this story before, but it's still a good one. So if anyone wants to. You know, grab your Valium and strap in.
Like 2 years ago or 2 or 3 years ago now, when I first moved to Orange County, I came on the first Thanksgiving away from home. And I didn't really know anybody well enough at that point to just invite myself over. I wasn't invited. And, you know, it's just whatever. We were on break. And I was living with an elderly lady at the time who was... the room I was renting was in her house. And so I just kind of assumed she had a big family who always came over for various things and stuff. So like, oh, I'm sure they're going to be doing Thanksgiving and I can probably grab a plate or whatever. And then I didn't know because she never told me and I didn't ask, but she ended up going somewhere else altogether for Thanksgiving. So the house was just empty all day and it was raining, which is rare in Los Angeles, but I guess not November. And so, it 9 o'clock rolled around. I was like, well, I guess if I'm going to get something to eat, I better do that. So with the same idea that I had this year, except for I was able to accomplish it, I went out to a KFC nearby to get something, at least mashed potatoes and gravy. I think that constitutes as Thanksgiving-ish.
Yeah.
And some sort of breaded bird. But because it was so late, by the time I got to the KFC in Garden Grove, they were closing. Uh-huh. And, I was knocking on the window or whatever, cause I saw that they were putting chairs up. And one of the guys, who was working there, cleaning and stuff, cause they were still helping a few people, who were still in there. He opened the door for me and let me in. And then a manager guy came out and was I'm sorry, we're closed. We can't serve you. And wow. So
on Thanksgiving.
So I had to turn around and then leave. And then I ended up going to Lee's Vietnamese sandwich joint next door. And it was this really dry Vietnamese sandwich on baguette. And that's pretty much the story.
Couple things. First thing, I said volume, and I don't know why I said volume. I should have said Prozac or Paxil or Zoloft. Volume was not the correct drug choice for that joke. So okay. I apologize for that. I have to say this disclaimer. My wife's a pharmacist. Mm-hmm. She'd kill me if she heard this. I used to be a pharmacy technician. I should know better. Not Valium. Prozac.
Well, you moonlight as a comedian, and people don't know this, actually, but your whole bit is you explain your jokes. You tell really bad jokes, and then the second half of your set is to explain at great
detail
why
it's the just joke is bad. It's just me going through all of them, beat by beat. Some podcasts have a corrections department thing. Right. I was just self-correcting.
You know, if anybody wants to email in to tell you why you're full of shit and why you don't know anything about pharmacy, that would probably be your wife. I will accept it, any kind of feedback at this point. So, okay, well, today we're going to be reviewing Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. And at the end of the show, we're going to talk about Quiz Show. I was going to tell a story about how, basically I have to pack up my entire room like I'm moving because they're repainting and reflooring everywhere. And then while I moved one of my bookshelves I keep all my movies on that was, underneath a window, I noticed, it had caught a bunch of water at some point, so now there's mold, and now they have to do that. So that's a whole story I'm not going to go into, but that's been my life over the last week.
Fun.
Right now I'm living in boxes like I'm moving. But let's get into the movie news. I wanted to just get your take, your hot take.
All right.
On this one. Anne Rice has got the rights back to her Vampire Chronicles, the series of vampire books she wrote in the 90s. And she's talking about adapting it as a TV series, starting with, I guess, the Vampire Lestat, then going on to Interview and whatever else, Queen of the Damned. A lot of these, or at least two of those, have been made into movies already. Neil Jordan directing Interview with the Vampire back in the early or mid-90s, and Queen of the Damned, that thing with Aaliyah in the 2000s, the soundtrack by Korn. But I guess, I don't know. Do you think this is too little too late? Is the vampire thing already crest?
I don't know. I mean, I don't have a problem with it. I liked Interview with the Vampire. I think it's, smutty enough and fantasy enough to totally work as a TV series, on Stars or HBO or whatever. Does it need to happen? Probably not. But there's so much TV out now. And why say anything shouldn't happen as far as TV's concerned? Like, if somebody wants to put the time and budget into making it good, then why the fuck not? I don't know.
Right.
Interview with the Vampire was a good movie, but Queen of the Damned sucked. So
it has its fans, though. Queen of the Damned has, like, its own little weird fan club of, like,
yeah,
goth kids of a certain age.
Yeah.
But I'll say this about the whole thing. It's not a matter of whether or not it should happen. I think there's, you know, the Vampire Chronicles, there's enough there, there's enough lore, there's enough canon to make some interesting stories, you know, with a good enough budget and a good enough cast, they could do good things with it. I just wonder if people are going to care, because arguably Anne Rice kind of set the template for which all of the sort of romantic, gothic vampire stuff after it would follow, including Twilight, television's The Vampire Chronicle or Vampire Diaries that's on.
Yeah, CW. But I mean, that show still does really well. And I mean, True Blood did really well.
Which just barely ended. But I'm just wondering if it's a little oversaturated right now. And because she's sort of the template, are people going to see that and think, oh, this, it's so archetypal that it just feels been there, done that. Like how people felt about the John Carter movie. It's like, why would I need to see this when we have Star Wars and Dune and all of these other things that basically ripped off John Carter?
Yeah, but also that wasn't like a terribly good movie. Like, I think it'll come down to quality of the show, because I might have agreed with you or that sentiment. I'm not saying you necessarily represent that sentiment. I don't know why I'm qualifying that, whatever. But I would agree with that if it wasn't for The Walking Dead. I mean, that show was coming out like after zombies had peaked.
You think I feel like that was the moment it peaked.
I think somehow that show managed to keep it going.
They gave it a second wind.
Yeah, and I think outside of The Walking Dead, it's done. Like, zombie stuff.
It is done
right
now. Yeah.
But The Walking Dead still gets, like, insane ratings and does really well. So I think it just comes down to the show, how well it's written, if they get a good cast, if it's marketed well. Because that's the thing about The Walking Dead. They market it like crazy. I don't know if I've shared my thoughts on that show on this podcast before. I think I have. Not a huge fan. But they market it really well. And that's one thing. I mean, that's sort of my problem with the show, is it's a little too marketed. Like, I don't feel like there's enough quality there, you know, to justify its marketing. But, like, you know, the whole fucking stupid season cliffhanger, the who did Negan kill bullshit, which that's a whole podcast. Like, I could do a whole fucking episode just on how The Walking Dead pisses me off and how that move in particular was total bullshit. But yeah, so I think it comes down to just quality. What the show is. If it sells well, if it's well acted, well cast, I think it could be a hit.
I could be into it. And if she has the rights, ostensibly she would have probably some creative input as an executive producer or a consultant or something.
I mean, Robert Kirkman does with The Walking Dead. Again, you going back to that example, doesn't make it not a shitty, shitty shit show, but he is involved. And, you know, I think that probably helps.
I don't know if it does or not. I was an early, I was early on the Walking Dead hate before it was cool to hate.
Yeah,
not hate. Hate's a strong word. It's not interesting enough to hate. I liked the pilot. Why are we talking about this? I liked the pilot, and then like four episodes in, I was like, I actually don't care. I've wanted this show since the comic first started, and here it is, and I don't really care for it.
Real quick, it starts at don't care, it gets to hate.
Next story. Joaquin Phoenix, Gus Van Sant are going to reunite for a biopic on famed cartoonist John Callahan. I don't know if you've looked at this story.
No. Who's John Callahan?
Who are all these names? He was published in The New Yorker, Penthouse, Playboy. So he's one of those kind of cartoonists. Adapted book since its publication in 89. I guess this project's been in the work for a while because at one point Robin Williams was attached to play the guy. So I'm guessing he was kind of like a Will Eisner, like mid 60s counterculture dude.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I don't know. Like
R. Crumb-ish kind of cartoonist guy.
Yeah, like, I get what you're saying. I don't know. Why not? It's really hard for me to get kind of invested in, like biopics anymore. I don't know. Like, I watch them and I'm like, oh, cool, or whatever. But I don't really get excited. I think the closest I've been to excited for something like that was when Sacha Baron Cohen was still attached to the Queen movie.
Yeah, we actually, on that episode I recorded with Patrick, we ended up not using the news, but we talked about, I've already forgot who they were going to get instead.
Yeah, someone...
Someone way not interesting.
It was someone much less exciting. I remember
It was the guy from Mr. Robot.
Yeah, I'm okay with that. I think Rami Malek.
Sure.
Rami Malek. Maleki. I don't know.
Not the way you're saying it, but that sounds right.
Yeah. He's really good in Mr. Robot, so I'm willing to give him a chance. I think he has a look for it. I just don't think that's as inspired as of a choice as Sacha Baron Cohen.
Right.
I remember I was like really excited about that, and then he was. You know, he left because of creative differences. And to me, that's like kind of a sign that it's going to be a pretty straight, like Hollywood by the numbers biopic. So I just can't really get excited for it. This thing with Joaquin Phoenix, Gus Van Sant.
Yeah,
sure. I mean, why not? I'll probably see it eventually someday on Netflix. But again,
it doesn't grab you. No, I understand. I thought you might be interested in the subject matter. I was hoping you would know who this cartoonist was, but that didn't.
If I look him up, I might recognize some of his work, but I don't know the name.
It says Callahan became paralyzed in a car accident at age 21 and turned to drawing as a form of therapy. For decades, Callahan's work raised eyebrows for its taboo topics, leading to numerous boycotts in his hometown of Portland. So that makes sense. Gus Van Sant's from Portland. A lot of his movies take place in Portland. He's like famously not into shooting in LA. Like he's like, if you have a movie for me, cool, I'll do it here. Otherwise, yeah. I'm just going to make my weird little movies here in Portland with teenagers or people who look like Kurt Cobain.
They really should have tapped him for all those Twilight movies.
I don't know. He might have done that. He's done some weird stuff. That's the thing. It's like with Gus Van Sant, with any kind of project he's going to be doing, my question is, which Gus Van Sant are we getting? Are we getting, Why Do Cowgirls Get the Blues and My Own Private Idaho and Elephant, like the really experimental Gus Van Sant, or are we getting like traditional Hollywood prestige film like Milk and Goodwill Hunting?
I guarantee you it all depends on who's paying for it. Mm-hmm. If it's a studio thing, if it's more of a, which I don't know, from the sound of it, like with Joaquin Phoenix, he's a bit of an oddball, a bit of an odd duck.
Both of them sort of like they're playful.
Yeah.
And I feel like they could bring the best out of each other. Like, cause even Milk, which is very traditional formally as a traditional kind of, biopic, I think is done with a little bit of kind of a political edge to it. And it feels a little bit more grounded and vital than the average kind of great man biopic. And I feel like maybe possibly this collaboration, plus him shooting in Portland, which he has some sort of connection to, could maybe keep it from being Finding Forrester.
Sure, yeah.
Also, there's an edgy kind of stuff here with, like, the nudity and the porn and whatever.
Yeah, I mean, if it... And it sounds like that's kind of the story to tell, so I don't know. We'll see. Yeah. Why not? Give it a shot.
I'll keep an eye out for it. I mean, Gus Van Sant, unfortunately, hasn't made, like, a really good movie in a while, but, you know. And he's kind of getting older, so we'll see if he has one or two more good ones in him.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's go ahead and get into our main reviews for the week, which is the Harry Potter spinoff, prequel, whatever you want to call it, expanded universe story, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. How would you describe the premise and plot of this film?
So we have a young wizard, a young man, Newt Scamander, who finds his way to New York City. Due to some beast-finding excursion, and he quickly gets sucked into this sort of political, wizarding political thriller involving, you know, the big bad of his time, Grindelwald, and, you know, he finds some New York wizards and a muggle, and they go on an adventure, and it's magical!
This is also directed by David Yates, who did the last few Harry Potter films. I think he did Order of the Phoenix all the way through to the end of the series. And, you know, that series went through, like, a big evolution of its own, watching it go from Chris Columbus kind of essentially making these, like, kiddie movies, and Alfonso Cuarón really bringing his style to the third one, and then so on and so forth. And by the time you get to Yates, it was clear that the movies were getting darker and older, and not older as in, like, actual age, but like the ages of the actors and the content was skewing older.
Yeah, and I mean that's true to the books too, you know.
Right.
J.K. Rowling really wanted to write, you know, it was meant to represent each book was meant to represent like a year, an actual year of school. And so the books the stories mature along with the characters, and you know, I think that's a big part of why they held such fascination with people is because, you know, a lot of the readers were going through this, maybe, you know, obviously not the dark wizarding stuff,
right?
But like, you know, they're going through some of the same drama stuff as far as like, you know, being a teenager and hating your parents because they shove you in a closet under the stairs and you know,
all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so it's relatable to the audience. And this this is, I don't know, I think this is an interesting movie because
it doesn't,
you know, it's J.K. Rowling's first screenplay, like straight to movie adaptation screenplay. There was a book.
I wasn't sure if this, because I've seen, like, I was at Barnes & Noble recently. And they were telling,
we're going to dig deep. Okay.
Oh, boy.
So
you got the digs on the Harry Potter stuff.
So Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them is one of the books in the Harry Potter book series. So it's like one of the books that Harry and Hermione and Ron have to purchase for the school year. So at first, it was just a reference to a book within a book. But then J.K. Rowling went and, like, before she did the play and, you know, started writing other books under her pen name.
Yeah.
She just for funsies wrote a small collection of some of the school books that they'd have to buy. It includes Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. I think Quidditch Through the Ages and one more. And they're kind of just like encyclopedias. So it's sort of like filler, you know, universe filler. So they were like a fun, like, I got them for my wife, Ashley, because she's a huge Harry Potter fan. And, you know, they're just fun. They're
essentially her Silmarillion.
Yeah. I mean, they're not even that in depth. They're like I said, it's just like an encyclopedia. It's like, if you picked up a Marvel encyclopedia that, you know, shows you all the way the X-Men mansion is laid out and
like a Bible.
Yeah, yeah. And but written in like a fun way of like, ooh, we get to experience this this book. So that is the basis. There's no story, but okay, there's a little bit of a story. Because in the acknowledgments in the back, it gives like the author's bio. And so that is a little bit like you see big bullet points of where the story's going to go based off of that. Because they kind of reference like some of this stuff in a very vague, like she definitely has free reign to make these stories like
however kind of she
whatever
wants. Yeah.
They want to be. So it's, man. This is long-winded. For all intents and purposes, it's an original story screenplay.
Right, because what I saw at Barnes & Noble was bound editions of the screenplay. So it's like, okay, I guess there was never a book, but now I'm getting the full story. I think this is a kind of an interesting step for her within this world, this Harry Potter universe that she created, mostly because it does away with all the trappings of the high school conceit. Mm-hmm. So, and also does away with all of the trappings of like the Campbellian Chosen One stuff.
Yeah, yeah, you don't have to deal with Harry.
You know, like, well, you're not following him. There's no ultimate evil versus ultimate good. There's no, you know, fate hanging. I mean, there's
isn't there?
There's a bad guy and there's a good guy, but it's not the fate doesn't hang in the balance.
Okay, here we go, digging deep again. So in the Harry Potter stories, they reference frequently Dumbledore's battle with Grindelwald. Okay. So we know that's coming. There is going to be a big epic battle between Dumbledore and Grindelwald. Like, it has to happen. They introduce Grindelwald in this movie. It's a different story, but it is. I do think they are going to follow a bit of that hero's journey. I think it might be broken up a little bit. It might be a little more interesting because Dumbledore is not even in this movie. It's about Newt.
Right.
So I just know at some point we're going to get to meet Dumbledore, a young Dumbledore. And at some point there's got to be this epic battle between Dumbledore and Grindelwald. And I'm curious to see what she does with that, because all we know is the story that people tell about Dumbledore and Grindelwald. We never saw it. There wasn't ever any flashbacks. And so, oh man, this is so nerdy. It's great. So I kind of wonder if there might be, I definitely think there might be some of the story that we don't know, because as we learn from Dumbledore in the later movies, he's not everything that you see. Like, not everything that they say about Dumbledore is necessarily true. There's some secrets there. And
so I can literally hear you pushing your glasses up your nose right now.
I kind of think that might be something that happens, is that,
all right.
Maybe Dumbledore isn't, again, everything we know him to be.
And the way that the movie ends, it leads us to believe there will be sequels. Yeah this movie's done, I think, pretty well, so... Let's talk about the movie that we did see.
Yeah.
What I was going to say, what I think is interesting about this movie is that it, because we don't have like a central hero, really, we have a cipher kind of, but the movie shifts around from perspective quite a bit. And we're introduced to all these different situations. You have his situation, which is basically he's like trying to find like, Harry Potter universe Pokemon that have escaped from his suitcase that he carries around.
Let's talk about that for a second. It's a shitty suitcase. Like, if you're keeping all these critters in your suitcase, like, get some fucking locks, dude.
Well, I mean, it shows early on in the thing. Like, there's, like, he has, like, a secret lock to where if a muggle, or in America, they're called nomads. If they were to open it, then it shows them just his socks or whatever. So I mean, it may be made to look inconspicuous.
Yeah, but the lock literally kept popping open through the movie, and that's how like the little snuffle creature gets out.
As rich as J.K. Rowling is, she has some very convenient writing devices that she leans on quite a bit. And I think we see a few of those in this movie, but I'll get to that in a little bit. So we're introduced to his situation. He's trying to find his animals. He's also trying to release one in Arizona, where you learn about that a little bit later. He has this interaction with Eddie Redmayne, I should say, plays the main character, recent Oscar winner Eddie Redmayne. And he has a run-in with this nomad muggle who wants to be a baker, played by Dan Fogler, who is probably my favorite performance in the movie because it's kind of a thankless sort of bumbling sidekick performance, but it's a totally integrated performance.
Are we going to... Because there's a lot going on in this movie. Are we going to talk about that now?
A little bit, yeah. I just want to kind of set up what I'm kind of seeing structurally happen. So there's that, and he has to kind of guard him from the magic world because this takes place in like the early turn of the century when like magic was supposed to be even more underground and more hidden, and that's the sort of the political stuff you're talking about, which obviously there's echoes into the modern day. Well, I mean, everything's kind of echoing like crazy right now because we live in such political times that like I can't watch like a fucking commercial without it like resonating in some weird way.
cry as like random commercials.
Right. And both movies we're talking today, you can like make clear references to what's going on now. But yes, you know, they're talking about, you know, like it obviously echoes a lot of like what's going on with the LGBT movement, what's going on with civil rights in general. You know, this idea of being closeted is like a big thing that's going on in this movie. And then you have
similar themes to like the X-Men stories too.
Yeah, very, very much so. And then especially in the other segment of the movie, which is almost like its own weird little movie. You have Ezra Miller and Samantha Morton, who are running this like conversion therapy school that's anti-witch.
Yeah, what was it, Second Salem or New Salem or something like that? Yeah,
something like that. And everyone thinks she's just a crazy person on the street, but she actually knows that they're the witches because she's actually like abusing witch children in her school. Ezra Miller is giving like his usual like super creepy performance and doing that pretty well. One of my complaints with the movie, I think overall I like it. I think it's fun, and if you're into this as much as you clearly are, then you'll be into this. I feel like the movie is not very concerned with the people who are just entering for the first time, for the initiated. I feel like it really drops you in the middle of a lot of stuff going on, and it takes a good amount of time to tie up all these different plot threads in a way where you understand who is what and what everyone's goal is and what the ultimate point of the movie is. It takes about 40 minutes before we have a good idea of like, oh, okay, so that's what's going on.
Yeah, but you know what? This movie is interesting to me because so far, not many things have been able to pull off the cinematic universe model that Marvel set up. We have Marvel. And we have Star Wars, which is also doing their first foray into like not
expanded universe stuff.
Yeah. And so this is, to me, this movie's interesting for that because like you really do need to have some knowledge of Harry Potter and the world going into it, but I don't think that's a bad thing. I mean,
not necessarily.
It would be kind of hard for somebody who has no concept of what's going on in Harry Potter at all to just like be thrown into this film because there's a lot that's not explained. And I kind of liked that.
Well, it definitely has kind of an elusive way of kind of doling out the information and the needed exposition. It wants to keep things kind of close to its chest and reveal things as it goes. The movie sort of blossoms as a story. Which is interesting, and I sort of like that structure, but I feel like it kind of doesn't lend to this movie as well because we don't really have a central character to get behind. We don't have a Harry Potter in this movie. Even Newt, Redmayne, who is giving a performance, but I feel like the character is more of a performance than a character. we're never really told all that much about him. We don't really know what he's all about. Even by the end of the movie, we know that he's basically like a good guy. But other than that, we don't really have a whole lot to hang on to. And because the movie is kind of shifting around from all these different story elements for, as the movie goes, and then they tighten and tighten and tighten as the plot sort of condenses, it just becomes a little difficult to care all the time. I found myself sort of attracted to certain elements more than others. Like, I was really into what's going on with Samantha Morton and creepy Ezra Miller. Like, there's this other little fairly dark and, like, that movie I was a little more interested in than Dan Fogler and Eddie Redmayne running around catching Pokemon.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, there's a lot going on in this movie, but I went and saw it with a bunch of Harry Potter fans.
Sure.
And the general consensus seemed to be seemed like people were a little underwhelmed because, I mean, one of the things that you got with Harry Potter was you got to enter this world as a child and really, you know, you get taught the magic as you go. And it is magical. You really get to learn the magic and experience the magic. And this movie kind of operates on a learning curve. Like it's not really, you know, they don't really break down a lot of the magic.
It's a pop quiz. Yeah.
Kind of. But I don't necessarily mind that. Honestly, what this movie kind of felt like to me was a big episode of Doctor Who.
Yeah, sure did, didn't it? I was thinking, like, this is as close to, like, a Doctor Who movie.
Yeah.
That we've
gotten. I mean, even down to the suitcase, which is bigger on the inside, you know, which is a huge thing from Doctor Who lore. His TARDIS is, it's a time-traveling movie. We're taken back to the 20s in America, which, you know, like, that's what Doctor Who does. So that's honestly what it felt like to me. And I think, again, part of the reason why I liked it so much.
Yeah, I love the production design. I love the era. And I think that David Yates is really good at visuals, and he's really good at setting a tone and a mood. Sometimes I think the movie is a little too dreary for its own good. Like, it clangs a little bit with when you're supposed to have those kind of Spielbergian awe moments.
Yeah.
And then it kind of goes back into, like, Samantha Morton beating Ezra Miller with her belt. Like, sometimes the movie isn't quite sure what movie it wants to be. But I actually, despite all of those things I said, structurally, I think that the movie doesn't do a lot of, it is going to be more challenging for people to get into, even Harry Potter fans, I think, because of the fact that we don't really have a central character. But I do sort of commend it for challenging its form and not leaning on Harry Potter stuff.
Yeah, and overall, like, I think it's a pretty smart movie. Like, it's not just a big action set piece to big action set piece. Like, there's a lot of, like, even I do kind of agree that we don't really have a central character to hang on, but I do think there's some slow moments. There's some there's some great characters, even though it's kind of hard to figure out who the main character is. Like the Kowalski character, Dan Fogler, you mentioned him. To me, he's literally the humanity in this film and the heart.
Film. Yeah.
And in his story, which is a story within a story, is to me so, like, heartbreaking and sort of beautiful that I did forgive a lot of the other stuff because I was like, well, like, this is enough for me to hang on to. You know what I mean?
That was enough of an emotional core.
Yeah. Because it's a complete story. That's another thing I really liked about it. Even though it's this sort of ambitious universe building story that is a little frayed and a little chaotic and there's a lot going on, it's still a whole story. It definitely sets up a sequel, but I don't think it relies on a sequel. Like, I think you could watch just this movie and be perfectly satisfied.
Yeah, I do agree with that. And as the movie condensed, and as by the 40 minute mark, when I kind of knew who all the players were on the chessboard and what moves they needed to make, then I was able to kind of, like, get on board with it. And I was like, okay, I see what you did. Now we're here. cool. I just thought it kind of moved in fits and starts and had some pacing issues but all to the service of an interesting screenplay, mm-hmm. but maybe just was a little unwieldy.
Yeah, maybe a little heavy. Maybe some stuff got cut that shouldn't have. Maybe other stuff should have got cut. I don't know, but
a little front heavy.
But again, I think that's kind of the case with all the Harry Potter movies. Most of them. And so I guess I was kind of expecting that again, because most of the Harry Potter stories are sort of mysteries that are sort of slowly unraveled, and this kind of.
They're basically Hardy Boys with magic.
That's oversimplifying it, but sure.
To the point of being reductive, but yes.
Yeah, but I think this movie is kind of structured the same, even though the story is different, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, it still unravels like a mystery, even though there is a bit of a mystery, but I don't think that we really needed.
And maybe it was just the period stuff, I'm not sure, but you know what it kind of reminded me of?
What?
It reminded me of Guy Ritchie's first Sherlock movie a little bit.
Okay.
Which had a similar sort of mystery setup where by the end you'd learn like, oh, the players aren't who you think they are, and people start kind of turning on each other and that kind of thing. Had a similar kind of payoff.
The difference is I think that Sherlock Holmes is a mystery, whereas this movie isn't really, or I mean, it kind of wants to be. There's mystery elements, but I thought the mystery was pretty easy to figure out, and so sort of removed from what the actual story was. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, you have Newt and his adventures and all this stuff going on, and then in the middle of it, you also have this sort of half mystery that I don't think necessarily needed to be so mysterious, but with
involving Colin Farrell and the minister. Well, they're not the Ministry of Magic. Whatever the magicians, the FBI, in New York. And
even the story with Ezra Miller. Like, I don't think that needed to be, because that's sort of confusing. What all's going on there? And I think maybe being a little more upfront with that could have done the movie some favors. But whatever. Overall, I still had a great time. There's plenty of Fantastic Beasts.
There are those moments, special effect moments, which it's really, really hard to get me to care about CGI. Like, at this point, like, I figure you can make whatever you want. You can dream something and make it the next day in CGI. So it's really hard for me to, like, be like, oh, wow, that is something I've never seen before. Because I get it. You have computers. You can do anything. Mm-hmm. But the imagination and the character design of the creatures.
Oh, my gosh.
There was like, some really fun stuff in here. And I forget that's something that Harry Potter and the Harry Potter world has always been able to do really well, is imagining what they're going to design.
Yeah, and I think that's also definitely one of the movie's biggest charms is the creatures. Although there's some
movies that has nothing to do with them, really.
Yeah, yeah. They're just the excuse for Newt to be there.
Yeah, they are MacGuffins on where to find them.
Yeah, but again, like you said, they're so fun and imaginative that they really could have been way lazier with the beasts, and I think a lot of people would have forgiven them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. My only other major complaint with the movie is, and this goes back to what I was hinting at with J.K. Rowling as a writer, she is the queen of the Deus Ex Machina, and there's a pretty obnoxious one in this as well. I mean, if you thought the time turner was annoying, the final conclusion in this movie is pretty convenient, to say the least.
Oh, I think I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
I mean, she's I think famously writes herself in these corners and then just comes up with a spell that makes everything better.
That's, again, I think that's kind of a Doctor Who thing. They do that a lot in Doctor Who, and where they literally write the Doctor into impossible situations.
Yeah.
And then part of the fun of it is watching him overcome these impossible situations. And I think maybe J.K. Rowling, because I do agree, maybe she could have a little more fun with that. Maybe, you know, be a little more knowledgeable about it and be like, yeah, this is fucking
magic. I mean, it isn't all the time, but in a lot of the Harry Potter movies and then this one, she'll often lean on this thing when she's like, oh, she write them into this situation. But it, rather than like them learning how to figure it out strategically, there's like somebody comes out of the blue and says like, oh, there's this spell we've never tried. And they just like erase the whole problem.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, maybe if she was a little more, maybe if she called it out a little more. But yeah, I kind of agree with that. Can we talk about one more thing that is very spoilery? So I want to give the spoiler warning. Skip ahead 2 minutes if you don't want to hear this.
Okay, what's up?
Spoiler. Did Johnny Depp bother you? Cause I kind of have a, and I know it's kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. I was digging Colin Farrell. I knew something was going on there. He had some connection to Grindelwald, and then we get the reveal that he's actually Grindelwald and it's Johnny Depp, and it's Johnny Depp with a very unfortunate haircut. And very unfortunate mustache. And I just, he's so Johnny Depp at this point that I was sort of disappointed. I mean, I get what they want. They want, you know, they want a big name for their big bad. I get that. But I just, that sort of took me out of the movie. That was like my biggest complaint was the Johnny Deppening.
And it was very much like a, now you're really going to want to see that sequel kind of thing. Like, it was supposed to be a hook, and it actually, for me, was quite the opposite.
Yeah, like, I
was like, oh, that's too bad. I was really kind of digging Colin Farrell in this.
Yeah, and I figured Colin Farrell was, like, working for Grindelwald. I thought he would be sort of, like, the Lucius Malfoy character, or even a Snape-type character. And so I was disappointed that the hope of that went away.
It's going to be another big scene-chewing, campy Johnny Depp performance.
I do think J.K. Rowling is aware enough, and I think David Yates has been able to work with a lot of stars very well, and balancing star power-heavy performances as supporting players. I mean, there's every British actor ever is in the Harry Potter universe as a supporting actor. So I'm hoping that they're able to sort of keep it under Johnny control Depp. And maybe we get a better Johnny Depp, you know, more of a Jack Sparrow. And I mean that not as like goofy, drunken, whatever, but as a character that serves the movie and makes the movie better versus, I don't know,
Mad Hatter or whatever.
Yeah. Versus just idiosyncratic and weird. But anyway, I guess, skip to this point.
Okay, and that was Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. I basically recommend it. I had fun. I think you do have to be a fan because this is basically fan fiction. But if you are, you've already seen it anyway. You really didn't need me to give you the recommendation. But if you do happen to get dragged along, you could see worse.
Again, I think that's a little reductive. But I thought it was fun. I think it's worth seeing, if for nothing else, than Dan Fogler's story arc as Kowalski and
that's fun. The wizard stuff is fun. Yeah.
I think you'll have a good time. And if you're not, then this isn't the movie for you.
It maybe doesn't have the grandiosity or the sort of the... It feels a little less substantial as a piece. It feels kind of tangential, but maybe that in and of itself could be your hook.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and move on to the Netflix homework, which stars Voldemort himself.
That's right.
1994's Quiz Show. This was directed by Robert Redford, and it was nominated.
You say that like you've never heard of Robert Redford before. You're like, it was directed by Robert Redford.
Whoever the fuck that is. No, Robert Redford directed this in 1994. This was nominated for Best Picture alongside Pulp Fiction and Forrest Gump, which ended up winning that year.
Oh, that was a tough year.
That was a really muscular year. But this is also a period piece that takes place in actual history, television history. This takes place in the mid-60s, or no, late...
I think it's like 58.
58, yeah, like late 50s. And stars John Turturro and Ray Fiennes. And it's all about this quiz show scandal that was going on at the time. This was the boom of the television era, the golden age of television. And television was experiencing a lot of new viewers, sweeping the nation. People weren't going to the cinemas anymore. Like, this was like a whole problem with film at the time. Because people were stuck at home watching these different kinds of programs. And also, this was like the beginning of when advertisers started collaborating with television a lot. And the kind of to an unholy marriage when it comes to these quiz shows. And you've seen Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. If you've seen, what's the one with Howie Mandel and the cases? You know, that's not really a quiz show, but...
Yeah, Deal or No Deal.
That's more just a game show, but you know.
Actually, this is kind of funny because I don't know if I'm actually allowed to talk about this, but Ashley and I auditioned for a game show that we might be on in next week.
A friend of the show, Alyssa Whitty, her and her mother were on Family Feud and ended up winning.
Oh, cool. We auditioned for Idiot Test and we get to go down to the studio and they might select us, they might not. So I don't know if we'll be on, but mm-hmm. But yeah, so it was kind of fun watching it with that in mind.
Oh, that is interesting. But I guess the big difference between those shows and this show, or at least I don't know. I'm not, you'll have to tell me like in the secrets, but off air, is that basically these shows were rigged. They knew who the winner, it was like professional wrestling. Mm-hmm. They knew who the winners were going to be. They knew who the losers were going to be. They were kind of creating characters out of these everyday people. Mm-hmm. And John Turturro plays Herbie Stemple, this kind of nebbishy Jewish guy from Queens who was supposed to be the everyman. And he had won so many weeks in a row. And the way the show works is you stay the champion until someone displaces you. But in this show, the show that they're on called 21, they get to stay as long as they're winning. And as long as they're winning, they're making money. And
more like Family Feud.
Right, right. And at some point, Herbie Stemple's ratings start to drop. People are less interested in him. And the television studio, I believe NBC, they believe that what they need is a corn-fed... Aryan white dude to displace him. And they find that in Charles Van Doren, played by a very young and very different Ray Fiennes, who's this erudite, family of money, college professor who comes from this very erudite family where they all kind of talk about, you know, they all speak in famous quotes from literature. Mm-hmm. And they believe that he's going to be this great sort of a thinking man's role model. So they make Herbie Stemple throw his final show. They bring in Charles Van Doren, and he's stuck with this dilemma, this moral dilemma of making a bunch of money and being able to be a celebrity mind.
Yeah, but he doesn't. The moral quandary comes from. He's lying. He's cheating. And is that right? Is that okay? Sure. That's sort
because
of
he is a smart guy, even though mm-hmm. he's getting the answers ahead of time. He is a smart guy and he wanted to be on the show legitimately mm-hmm. and he wanted to win legitimately. And he believes that intelligence is something to be modeled after, to be, an example of. And he doesn't feel like he's doing that, honestly. It kind of becomes a courtroom thing. Mm-hmm. We have Hank Azaria plays one of the stooges at NBC. And I'm trying to find who's the main character fella.
David Paymer as Dan Enright.
Dan Enright.
And Rob Morrow as Dick Goodwin is the federal investigator.
Yeah. And he's kind of outside of the investigators kind of searching into this, and he's trying to find, like, what's going on here, who's telling the truth, who isn't. And it kind of sort of becomes a Can't Fight City Hall type of story as well.
Mm-hmm.
But what did you think of Quiz Show? I've seen this thing, but it's been a long time until I rewatched it, and I forgot a lot about it.
I liked it. I want to say thank you for not making the Netflix homework like something weird that's gonna like make me feel uncomfortable. Like, I don't know. It was nice to watch a movie. You know, like they don't make movies like this anymore.
Right.
Like it was a big budget movie that was, you know, telling a personal morality story. And it was, you know, not like in this day and age, it would be an indie movie and it'd be like way darker and way weirder.
Right. Or it would be a lot more kind of moody or
and
it would be a lot more like a Philomena type of thing, which is. Whereas this movie wants to entertain everybody. This wants, exactly. This wants to be a big, I mean, it's also kind of playing around with the period, and it's kind of making reference to those type of movies that were made back in that time.
Yeah, but I liked that. Like, that was all stuff that brought me into what could be a really boring story. Because it's, you know, there's not really that much drama going on. You know, like you said, it's rigged and like, only two people really care, you know, John Turturro, who feels like he got ripped off. He really only cares because, like, he doesn't care about the show. He cares that they made him throw it on an easy question. So for him, it's all a matter of pride, and he wants to continue being on TV, even though he's not like a TV friendly personality. He's, you know, this awkward, sort of know-it-all. And so you've got his story of, you know, like him fighting his pride. And then you've got Ralph Fiennes, who's, fighting with, you know, is he doing
the right
thing? How does he do the right thing? He knows he's not doing the right thing. He just doesn't know how to do the right thing at this point.
Yeah. He gets in too deep before it's too late.
And, Paul Scofield plays his dad, Mark Van Doren, and he was nominated for something as a supporting actor. I think it was like a Golden Globe. And he gives such a small, nuanced performance that it was just beautiful. Like, all of the characters did way more acting than a movie now about this subject matter would have required.
It's a really great ensemble. I mean,
you
have a lot of great main characters between the three, you know, John Turturro, Ralph Fiennes, and David Paymer,
I would say Rob Morrow is.
Yeah, Rob Morrow, the detective. But everybody in the movie, no matter how big or small their parts are, really get a moment to shine.
Yeah, even Christopher McDonald, who just plays the host of the game show, he has this one moment, and this stood out to me because this would have hit the cutting room floor if this movie had been made like post 2010, where he's just saying his name, like he's introducing himself, like rehearsing before the camera. Mm-hmm. And it's just like this, it tells you everything you need to know about this character. And it's just beautiful. It's just this tiny character moment, is no exposition, is nothing. You know, nothing directly to do with the story. It's just all about building who he is, you know, and he's not even that integral to the plot. Like every character has kind of a little moment like that, which is nice.
Yeah, I really like the stuff. I mean, John Turturro is just great.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and this was one of the movies, this and Barton Fink and a few others early on that kind of propelled his career. But this one especially.
Have you seen, sorry not to go like completely off topic, but have you seen The Night Of?
No.
HBO miniseries?
I hear it's good.
Yeah, he's in that. And apparently the part was originally written for James Gandolfini, And James Gandolfini was a producer of it. And he had even shot the pilot episode. And I just can't even imagine, because John Turturro's performance, again, sort of propels that show.
Right.
Because he's such a good character actor.
Right. And he does that here. And I love the moments, the little moments when you see with his family.
Yeah.
You know, his wife and his kid who plays the drums annoyingly in the background during certain scenes. And like you learn so much about his little family situation in Queens just through these little the connective tissue between the exposition dialogue.
Yeah. Like his wife is on the phone with his mother-in-law. And that you get a lot of his motivation just from his reaction to her conversation. It's not something they have to spell out, which, I mean, they kind of do, but it's all.
I mean, the performance is arch.
Yes.
And it's supposed to be comedic, but it also feels real to a point. It feels understandable and relatable.
Yeah, that was to me what really grabbed me about this movie was just the acting, just the pure performances were so good and so subtle and small and that's what I liked about it. It wasn't like these boisterous performances. It wasn't a fucking Sean Penn, hamming it up, chewing scenery. They all felt very real to me.
And to the service of the movie.
Yes.
Yeah. Completely. As a whole. That's why it comes off as more of an ensemble than as a character piece of any one particular person. And we've seen Ralph Fiennes be Voldemort. We see him play the Nazi, a literal Aryan Nazi in Schindler's List. Mm-hmm. And he's now been written a lot as a villain up until, thankfully, I think Wes Anderson used him against type very well.
Yeah, in Grand Budapest.
But he does really, really well in this movie as being a likable
intellectual.
Yeah,
handsome and charming, and it's and you really feel his moral question. It's so believable. And again, I think a big part of that is the scenes with his dad are almost heartbreaking, just because, again, they don't directly talk about how much he wants his dad to be proud of him, but it's there. Like, it's there in their performances.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in this movie, I think, about masculinity. There's a lot going on in this movie, I think, about bigotry and race and post-World War II feelings at the time.
Yeah.
Some of that stuff is spelled out pretty openly about them wanting somebody less Jewish and more Jewish. And I think at one point, like the main character, the FBI guy whose name I can never remember,
Rob Morrow.
Yeah. He's at one point, his wife calls him Uncle Tom Jew because he wants to help Ralph Fiennes rather than convict him.
Yeah. Well, and that's another thing, is the stakes could feel very low in this movie because Ralph Fiennes isn't actually on trial. The whole point of this FBI investigation is not to get anyone to serve jail time, but Dick Goodwin, Rob Morrow's character, is trying to indict the television industry.
Right.
And set the industry standard. He's trying to prove that NBC as a company was implicit in rigging these games, in defrauding, the American people. And his intention is to not embarrass the contestants who just went along with the system, and that, it kind of gets out of his control. Ralph Fiennes, his conflict is entirely internal. He never faces the threat of jail time. It's all about, the threat of his reputation and how people will perceive him, which, is almost worse because it feels a little more real. Mm-hmm. Like it feels more personal. It doesn't have to be this giant epic, if you do this, or if you're caught, your life is gonna, you know, you're gonna rot in jail.
It's not Sophie's Choice.
No, it's
kind of thing.
It's not, and it's refreshing to see the characters react the way they do, because you know that it is a personal conflict, not external conflict, and that's, to me, that was refreshing.
But I also think that the movie does a really good job, and what makes it feel bigger or more important than the stakes would lead you to believe, is I think the movie does a really good job at using the personal stories as a metaphor for the bigger stories.
Yeah.
And what I think was, you know, this movie is really essentially an origin story for how television has become less about, you know, because there was a point of time when being an intellectual was like cool. When you would go on like Hollywood Square, well, Hollywood Squares was kind of the beginning of the end, really. But you would go on like the Dick Cavett Show, or you would go on like, you know, any of those old talk shows from like the 50s and 60s, and they would always have people like Truman Capote on, or like Allen Ginsberg, or people like that, just to hear them talk and to pick their brain, because it was like, here's the greatest thinkers of our day.
Yeah.
And, you know, even by 1994 standards, which seems like, you know, a totally different world to us now. But it really, the movie really feels prescient, because this is kind of like pre-reality TV.
Yeah.
But it's kind of talking about that. It's talking about how, you know, there's this one kind of central scene with Martin Scorsese, who plays a character in the movie, where he's like a studio exec or exec or something like that. And he says something to the effect of, well, who cares? Because, you know, if we have to end up, you know, being more truthful or whatever, we'll just make the questions easier. People don't care about whether or not people are smart. They care about following the money. They care about wealth. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I also think
it's telling.
I also think it, again, like you kind of mentioned with Fantastic Beasts, it was pretty relevant with, like, you know, this fucking election cycle and
television and creating celebrities
and just the lack of accountability. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this wasn't about the news. This was about, you know, entertainment talk shows. But we're kind of dealing with that now, with the lack of accountability in the news, you know, and how
well, the entertainment world has pretty much taken over the news world.
Yeah.
They're one and the same now.
Exactly. Because the, you know, news industries care about getting tweets and retweets and likes on Instagram. And it's like, no, just tell us the fucking news. Like, you know, and that's kind of what, you know, what Dick Goodwin, his whole story is like, well, you know, it's a fucking game show. Like, you know, if it's going to be a game show, it shouldn't be rigged.
Well, but, and specifically they're implicating, I think this did have some legal ramifications, because I remember learning about this in a mass media course I took, like even after I'd already seen the movie.
Well, according to the ending, it was directly towards David Paymer's character, Dan Entwright, and NBC as a company didn't feel the ramifications of it. Again, that's according to the ending.
But there was like a rule set where, like, I forget how it played. You'd have to Wikipedia it or something. But there was a rule set to where, like, advertisers couldn't buy up a certain, like, show. Like, because at the beginning of every show, they're like, brought to you by Geritol, blah, 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 blah. And it was all just as an excuse to sell this thing.
Yeah, because even John Turturro's character, he would like directly plug the Geritol, like really awkwardly, and that was part of the reason.
Great little character touch too.
Yeah, but that was part of the reason they kept him around for so long, was because he, you know, he would plug the Geritol.
He was a willing shill. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
So I think that's the thing that changed. Is like shows could no longer like specifically sponsor like that.
Yeah,
I don't know. Learning about it once. You would have to look it up.
Sure.
But anyways, I love the movie. I think it's great. And I think it didn't seem to me at the time when I saw it when I was like 23 or 24. But watching it now, I would put it in that same class of weirdly prescient movies like Face in the Crowd or Network and those kind of films.
Yeah, and it also, like, it also stirred up in me feelings about other, like, shows and movies I like, which is always a good thing.
Oh, like Mad Men, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, Mad Men. It also made me think a lot of HBO's Newsroom, which got canceled way too early, because I would love to see that show tackle some of the issues today. Mm-hmm. Just because, like, the whole... Because Newsroom is about, you know, a newsman who wants to be accountable and credible. Right. And this is sort of the flip side of that, of people who just don't care at all. Full points to the Venture Brothers for referencing the quiz show scandals with the quiz boy character.
Right. That is, their nerd goes deep.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was great. Like, after watching it, I got so many jokes that I didn't really get before that I was just like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, that's the episode. And before we let you go, what do you want to promote this week? What's your Twitter? What's your thing?
Find you. Yeah, you can follow me at Keith Foster Kid. We have, I think, 3 more episodes of Tonight in San Diego for this season. Follow Tonight in San Diego on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Keith Foster Kid, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Tonight in San Diego, Monday nights, 7:30. Tickets available. The last 3 shows should be really good. And then we'll take another small hiatus. I have no idea. It'll probably be a month or so. And then we'll be back sometime in 2017.
Cool. And you can email the show if you have anything you want to say about anything we talked about on this episode. You can do so at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can follow me at BC Cassidy on Twitter. You can follow the podcast at Jabber Podcast. And you can find the podcast Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast.
Don't fucking email about the volume thing. I caught it.
Please do.
I caught it.
That's all I want to hear about. You can also listen to the archives of the show at jabberinthedrone.podbean.com, as well as Stitcher, iTunes, Player.fm, Pocket Cast, and the Windows Podcast Network. Maybe Google Play. I'm not sure. You can read my movie reviews that I do weekly at the Idaho State Journal at southforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can also read some of the reviews and content I provided for the Seattle-based McGuff.in/author/Cassidy. A friend of the show, Brad Decker, has a blog that he moderates over at Medium at panelandframe.com. And be sure to listen to friends of the show, Rod and Denise, at their music request podcast, The Listening Party, and Patrick, who we had on a few weeks ago, at Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational. That is the show, and we will talk to you later.
Fuck 'em all.
Bye.